Robin Young, it's here and now. We'll have a conversation with a dispirited AIDS activist, Larry Kramer, in just a moment. But first, President Bush announced today that he has called on U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, John Negroponte, to pack up his belongings in Baghdad and come home to become the nation's new intelligence czar. The official title is National Intelligence Director, a position created, in effect, out of the rubble of 9/11, his top assignment to prevent another 9/11 from taking place. Joining us now from Washington, Faye Bowers, National Security Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Faye, one of the things everyone was looking to hear was, who's going to oversee the huge budget of all the intelligence agencies? There are at least 15 intelligence agencies in the U.S. What is your interpretation of what the president said today about that?
Well, it sounded as if the president were going to give John Negroponte all the power, although the legislation that was passed the end of last year is a little ambiguous about that. And I think, as you mentioned, Negroponte will not only have, you know, 15 unwieldy agencies to oversee, but plenty of powerful personalities as well.
Well, one would ask, would, for instance, CIA Director Porter Goss have to report to Negroponte?
That's right, he will. Yes, he will.
At least after today. Well, let's listen to a little of what the president said this morning.
John and I both know that change, it can be unsettling. And so, therefore, I'm sure there's some people out there wondering right now what this means for their jobs and the influence of a particular agency into the White House. And the answer is everybody will be given fair access. And everybody's ideas will be given a chance to make it to John's office. And if he thinks it's appropriate, I see it, I'll see it. And if he thinks it's a waste of my time, I won't see it.
Well, Faye Bowers, some might wonder when he said there are people out there wondering what it means for their jobs, if the president might have been speaking directly to Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes, in some ways, yes. But I think Donald Rumsfeld, on the other hand, has plenty of access to the president through his role as Secretary of Defense, and that, you know, he oversees the Defense Intelligence Agency is only one part of his job.
Well, just yesterday, Senator John Rockefeller complained the Bush administration has been dragging its feet in naming an intelligence czar. Why has it taken so long to fill the post?
I think it's a very difficult position, as you know, former CIA Director Robert Gates turned the job down, and it's rumored that he was the first choice for that position, and it's not clear how many other people President Bush talked to, but it's taken more than 2 months since the legislation was passed to create this position to find someone, and I suspect from the people I've talked to who've looked at the job intently, it's that, you know, it's being seen as a person who can be blamed for everything and not get credit for anything.
Well, and let's talk about that person, the one who's been picked, John Negroponte, a career diplomat going back to the 60s. Tell us a little more about him.
Well, he was born in London to a Greek shipping magnate. He's a graduate of Yale University here, and he has a 40-year career in the U.S. government's Foreign Service.
Well, of course, as part of that, I just have to interject because there are people saying, yes, and wasn't part of that a key role in the Iran-Contra affair?
That's right. During the 80s, he was the ambassador to Honduras, and it's widely claimed that is the position that oversaw President Reagan's program to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua.
So what do you think of his selection given that? I mean, is it a sign that people who are involved in that world work well with diplomacy and intelligence, or is it proof of loyalty to the first President Bush?
I think it could be a little of both. There are a lot of people who worked during that period, you know, who are on the White House staff, and you know, they've worked together, including Colin Powell, for example, and Elliot Abrams and John Negroponte. They've worked for years together, and maybe it's just, you know, these are men who are seen as getting the job done, or, you know, that it's a little bit of loyalty, as you mentioned. Not clear to me.
Well, until this morning, the top intelligence story was that CIA Director Porter Goss told Congress yesterday that, as many critics have said, Iraq has become a recruiting and training ground for terrorists. And, of course, Negroponte's last job was in Iraq. Has he been seen as successful as ambassador to Iraq in just the few seconds we have?
I think he's been seen as being very successful. He, of course, oversaw the largest buildup of any U.S. embassy anywhere there, as well as, you know, Iraq's sort of baby steps to democracy with the recent elections. But he also saw this entrenched insurgency up close and personal, which may, you know, I'm speculating here a little bit, but it may be of what kind of led him to take this job or be considered for this job. It's because both Porter Goss and Donald Rumsfeld yesterday testified on the Hill that as the Iraq war wanes, these terror cells will be transplanted to other countries and be more of a threat possibly to the United States than they are.
Which he'll be dealing with in his new job. Faye Bowers, National Security Correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Washington. Faye, thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, news of a new highly drug-resistant strain of HIV is leading New York City health officials to think about changing the way they gather information about the spread of the disease, maybe even working with members of the gay community to confront people practicing risky behavior on the Internet or at parties. The strain, known as 3-DCR-HIV, has not been detected anywhere else in the world. Officials say it's nearly impossible to treat and speeds up the onset of AIDS. Joining us on the line from his home in New York City, Larry Kramer, a playwright, longtime AIDS activist. Larry, your first thoughts on hearing of this new strain of HIV?
I guess I was waiting for something like this, one thing or another. I felt for some time that the whole business is a house of cards, the whole treatment, the whole research, the whole everything, and it's going to come tumbling down one of these days. Mm-hmm. There are so many wonderful drugs out there now. There's something like 20 of them, and everybody who can is taking one or the other of them. Most of these drugs don't get along with each other, and when you're put on a cocktail, as almost everyone is, it's hard to get the right balance of which ones like each other in your body, and quite often you don't know for some time. And so this helps to make these viruses change and become slightly mutated. And if this virus doesn't turn out to be the virus, as some people are now saying, it's only a matter of time before there'll be another one and then another one. I think we're in for a long history. The next chapter of this plague, and we must call it a plague, is going to be seeing an awful lot of hideous things happening.
Well, in fact, some health officials are saying that this newly discovered strain of HIV is the super virus because it progresses so fast. And why else?
It doesn't respond to 19 of the 20 drugs that are out there for whatever reason. Because it's the virus is very smart, and it has learned how to sidestep the bullets that come after it. A virus has to fight to stay alive, and that's what it's been able to do, one of the smartest viruses ever, which is why there isn't a cure, basically.
Susan Little and her colleagues out in University of California, San Diego, said that in 2002, drug-resistant HIV affected as many as 1 in 5 newly infected people. But what you're saying is they might have been resistant to 1 or 2 or 3, but you could move to another drug.
Right. That's happened to me several times. Right. And they keep inventing new ones, and they keep the newer ones, and this is another double-edged sword, the newer ones are stronger than the old ones. So it's harder on your body. It tears your body down faster, even though it's a harsher drug and it's going to kill the virus harder. But it also makes the virus mutate. There's so many side effects. These drugs don't get along with each other, I've said. They're becoming stronger and harsher on our body. I've lost my appetite. I really don't enjoy food anymore. You have to take pills that make you pee all the time. I'm up 6-7 times a night urinating. So, of course, I'm thrilled to be alive. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying everybody thinks they're less harsh than they are.
Well, in fact, in a speech you gave at the Cooper Union in New York in November, you warned people that just this might happen, that drugs that are keeping people alive would one day stop working in one way or the other, that drug-resistant strains more and more would come forward. And you were, Larry, furiously outspoken about what you perceived as perhaps a younger segment of the gay population who just assumed, well, these drugs will keep me alive, so I don't have to worry.
I don't understand the kids of today. I really don't. It's almost as if they don't want to know what happened in the past. They shun older people. They shun anybody who has AIDS, who had AIDS. There's no respect for the dead or what we went through. It's almost as if they're so totally embarrassed by it all or something. I don't know. I can't figure it out.
Well, staying with the younger generation for a minute, you and others have spoken out about the use of crystal methamphetamine. How does crystal meth contribute to the spread of AIDS?
Well, it's a tranquilizer. It makes you feel good. It's an up, whatever I can call it. It's an antidepressant. It's basically what it is. And gay people have a lot to be depressed about, let's face it, especially young kids. you know, we're not allowed to get married. The government hates us. The church hates us. George Bush certainly hates us. All the Congress hates us. I guess if I were young and were a little uncertain about my place in the world, I'd want an antidepressant too. Makes you feel real good, and it gives you a lot of energy, and it makes you very hungry for sex, and it makes you very unselfconscious, like antidepressants do, and it makes you throw away all inhibitions, and your behavior becomes unaccountable somehow.
Well, and as much as you're just now expressing sympathy for why somebody might take crystal methamphetamine, again, I'm referring back to that speech, you were really ticked off about, you know, about the use of crystal meth.
I don't have sympathy for anyone. I hate when people get addicted to anything because it just starts such an awful chain of events in your life that are hideous. And crystal meth is very, very difficult to get off of when you're hooked.
And yet you said to people who are using it, you know, people look to me for the answers. You want answers? Crystal meth is not an answer.
It certainly isn't.
And you go on later to say, I'm sorry, it takes hard work to behave like an adult. It takes discipline. You want it to be simple. It isn't simple. Yes, it is. Grow up. Behave responsibly.
I think everybody's sick of it. Everybody is all activisted out. Mm. There are not very many activists left, as a matter of fact. There's none of that left. So everybody who is not dead has either gone on to something else in the world and not paying much attention to gay rights or AIDS activism, or they work for one of the organizations so that they, in fact, have been co-opted by the system. So there's no one out there really making any noise. I don't know that I have answers for any of this. Prevention hasn't seemed to help in any community anywhere in the world. There's 70 million people out there infected, so none of the attempts at prevention have worked very well.
Well, Larry Kramer, what do you think about the people who are talking about things like going to places where people use crystal meth and busting up parties and you know, going on Internet sites and tracking down people who are, you know, using risky behavior, sort of a vigilantism?
Good luck to them. I don't think it'll get very far. It's probably against the law. And I don't really think it'll do that much. As I say, I don't think any efforts at prevention have ever really worked. I don't know how you shake up this community, and it's really not a community. It's just an awful lot of people all over the country who happen to be gay. There's no unity as a community would have. It's very hard to reach them. It's very hard to make people change their behavior. This is sex, remember. And the same problem exists in South Africa. You know, there's a part of South Africa where 7,000 people a day are getting infected. A day!
AIDS activist and playwright Larry Kramer on the newly discovered strain of HIV that's highly resistant to drug therapy. Well, when we come back, some pretty frank conversation about sexual behavior and the spread of AIDS. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're talking today with longtime AIDS activist Larry Kramer about a new strain of highly drug-resistant HIV that's been discovered in New York City. Officials in New York are working to track down partners of the one man diagnosed with the new virus. But meantime, AIDS activists are trying to figure out what to do. New cases of AIDS have dropped from the numbers of the 80s, but still hover at 40,000 new cases a year. Now, we want to let our listeners know that we're going to be discussing some adult topics and themes about sexual behavior in a very frank way that may be offensive to some. And we turn back to Larry Kramer. Larry, as we've been talking today, you sound completely discouraged, dispirited.
I'm not dispirited. Maybe I am. Maybe I refuse to admit it. I think you could call it the new realism. I think you have to at some point realize that in all these years since 81, we have not been able to achieve anything in terms of changing people's behavior and getting this community to fight back, to organize itself, any of these things. And after a while, you have to realize that you can only make so many speeches.
Well, in fact, one of the things you said in your speech at Cooper Union in New York was that having sex without a condom, having unprotected sex, was tantamount to murder.
Oh, there's no question.
But language like that from you, Larry, do you think that people who do that should be charged?
It's not murder. I mean, yes, it's murder, but it takes two. So it's a willing behavior on the part of both people. So I don't know if that quite qualifies murder in the same way, but it certainly is. We are murdering each other, and I don't think it's far-fetched to say that anymore. Maybe that strong language will help people to think twice. I don't know.
We mentioned earlier that New York health officials and some gay activists in New York are thinking of more aggressive methods of going after people.
People who are not activists who are saying this. There are no more activists left. There really aren't, except maybe me and half a dozen others. I can never understand why people don't fight to save their own lives. I couldn't understand it starting in 81, and I don't understand it now. You know, there were only a couple thousand kids out there who were in ACT UP who fought for those drugs that are out there now. Most of the people didn't do anything. People just don't want to fight to save themselves, and I don't understand that. I really don't.
Well, there are AIDS workers, I'm sure, who would argue that point, Larry, and also point out that not every gay man is involved in risky behavior, and they're not the only ones doing it, but that's the community that you represent. And so I want to ask, is there anything hopeful? You do sound so despairing. Are there any new strategies that you and others are talking about?
One of the suggestions that has just come forward, we really have to de-eroticize anal sex, because anal sex is the real problem. And someone has come forth with the idea of making something called frottage sexy. It's a very ancient way of having sex. It goes back to ancient Greece and Rome. And it basically involves the sexual organs rubbing against each other or against the skin to achieve orgasm, so that there's no actual entry into the body. And there are various websites now that promulgate this. And if you could make that the exciting way and not anal sex.
But how do you change thousands of years of worth of thinking about what is erotic?
Well, I mean, you look at a lot of pictures of guys doing it. But at least it's a positive suggestion, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not just yelling at everybody, hey, change your behavior. It's saying, hey, here is some behavior that you might consider trying because it's exciting.
Well, and, you know, I'm sure you think often of this. You actually mentioned this in the speech, that in condemning the risky behavior that you've been speaking about, it's the same behavior that you had when you were young.
Yes, this is true. This is true. And that's the reality of it all, I guess, you know. I was part of getting us into the trouble we're in, but we didn't know it at the time.
I found the words from your Cooper Union speech where you say, as I understand it, more and more new viruses and mutant viruses and partial viruses that are not understood are floating around. Are you ready for that one?
None of this stuff has been hard to predict. You know, everybody, even when whatever it was showed up in 1981, it was not hard to say, hey, why is anyone surprised? Because leading up to that, we had had all these other things, syphilis and gonorrhea and amoebas, and it just got kept escalating. And it didn't surprise me when something new came along. It doesn't surprise me when anything happens now. 70 million people walking around with this virus. That virus is going to do all kinds of peculiar, strange things that we haven't seen before. 20 or 19 very strong medicines out there. People are now taking 2 and 3 and 4 of them at a time. The body is going to do very many strange things because of that. Why are we surprised?
Here's another line of yours from that Cooper Union speech, which will be published in April. And by the way, you say, when are you going to realize that for the rest of your lives, probably for the rest of life on Earth, you are never going to be able to have sex with another person without a condom? Never. Every time you even so much as consider this, I want you to hear my voice screaming like crazy in your ears. Stop. Don't. Never. No way, Jose.
Robin, I've been saying this since 1981. You know, I was a pariah for many years. People would cross the street rather than walk on the same side of the street with me. I was told not to come back to Fire Island Pines, where I had a house. Please leave, because I said all these things. So it's not as if no one hasn't said them before. It becomes a very old record, and you think people must want to destroy themselves, I guess. And that's what I don't want to face up to.
AIDS activist and playwright Larry Kramer. He spoke to us from his home in New York City. The speech that Larry gave at Cooper Union in November will be published this April in a book entitled The Tragedy of Today's Gays. So, what are your thoughts? We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and town. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What Saddam Hussein called the mother of all battles is now producing what you might call the mother of all ironies. 17 American soldiers were shot down, captured, and tortured in Iraq in 1991, many of them in an Abu Ghraib prison run by Saddam Hussein. Now they are appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that the Bush administration is unfairly denying them compensation for being tortured in Iraq, while at the same time promising to compensate Iraqis abused in the same prison by American soldiers during the current war in Iraq. This week, the Justice Department may ask the U.S. Supreme Court to dismiss that appeal. Well, joining us on the line is one of the POWs, retired Air Force Colonel David Eberle, the senior officer among the former POWs. And, Colonel, hello.
Well, and good day to you, Robin.
And I should say welcome back, because we spoke to you before when this case first came up. And now that it's an appeal, I just wanted to point out, I find it so ironic that your case is now called ACRI versus Iraq and the United States. Did you ever think that you're... You know, as a POW in 91, did you ever think that you'd be having a case against Iraq and the United States as allies?
No, not at all. And, you know, first of all, let me just say that I hope your listeners continue to support those men and women who bravely go forward to serve our country today, not only from the active but the Guard and Reserve forces. They need to know that their country stands behind them all the way from the day that they raise their hand, you know, until the day that they retire or return home.
Even if some of them, and you included, are now questioning the American government. And let's remind people what happened to you. You were shot down on the fourth night of the first Gulf War. You were captured, severely beaten, lost 45 pounds. Were you in Abu Ghraib?
Yes. We were actually held in four different prisons, including some of those that have made headlines over the past year, one of which was Abu Ghraib.
Yeah. And were you beaten? Was it mostly emotional torture? What, you know?
Well, it was both. It was both. And some of those stories, including the electric shock treatment and that sort of thing, I think the focus here needs to be positive and seeing that people want to move forward.
So now fast forward, and you decide to sue, which you have the right to do under all sorts of conventions, and then American law in 1996, a law was passed. And you sued for compensation, and you meant for the money to come from Iraq.
That's correct. And we still have great political support on both sides of the aisle.
You did win a rather large judgment of several million dollars. Almost immediately, Bush administration lawyers argued that the claim should be dismissed. This is now during the second Iraq war, and the argument was that those funds needed to go to rebuild Iraq. Were you shocked?
I think shocked, dismayed, left with a great deal of misunderstanding of how justice lawyers could argue the point that this whole record of mistreatment needs to be just thrown away, shredded, and pretend as though it didn't happen. And then we get the comment by Secretary Rumsfeld nearly a year ago where he says, you know, the situation, and it was in very poor situation where we had a few U.S. military people mistreat the Iraqis at Abu Ghraib, but all of a sudden then the Secretary of Defense decides that he needs to seek compensation for a few Iraqis that were mistreated by U.S. military and completely ignores the situation that was covered under the 96 legislation where you had a terrorist state grossly mistreat those people who come under the Geneva Convention.
Can you understand, though, the question of who exactly is Iraq to the U.S. now? It's not an enemy nation at this point. And some
well,
people...
it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah. But just like with the situation in Libya, a state never ceases to exist. You know, you have a situation where the political scene changes from time to time, but the state is always held responsible for its actions.
Right. Did other POWs, I'm thinking of, for instance, now Senator John McCain, who was a POW in Vietnam, did they win sums of money from Vietnam?
No, the Congress, the legislation that was created in 96 was not in place there.
Right. So, and they weren't grandfathered.
Right.
It wasn't included in. Well, what have you thought, Colonel, over the last couple of years, as you've watched the war in Iraq unfold and seen, for instance, images of Abu Ghraib, the same prison you were in, and seen pictures of torture at a place where you suffered at the hands of your captives?
Well, it never goes away. I think anyone who has ever lost their freedom for 5 minutes or 5 days or 5 years, certainly with people, heroes in our case, such as McCain and others, it never goes away. And Americans, whether they serve in the military or serve as civilians in defending our flag, need to understand that they're protected by their government and the government stands behind them.
I think it sounds like what you're saying as well is that all soldiers need to be protected because, as you said, you know, you had feelings for the Iraqis as well.
Well, that's true. And one of the things that we would hope to do with this, you know, we've established a foundation to help the families of those who may find themselves in this situation. The other thing that the foundation hopes to do is take an initiative to the United Nations that will reinvigorate Article 3 of the Geneva Convention to at least include states that are currently on the books today.
You referred to Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. That's the provision that pledges to never absolve a state of any liability for the torture of POWs.
Correct.
Right, so that you feel that Iraq should still be made to pay.
Absolutely.
On the other hand, I mean, just again, in your account of being in the prison, you also tell of the kindness of an Iraqi on the day you were going home. The Iraqi soldier who came to you and, you know, they'd been playing good cop, bad cop, and you weren't sure what to make of him.
Right.
And he told you you're going home. And what else did he say to you?
I hesitantly put my arms around him, and he did the same. And he could see that I possibly was about to crack. And he whispered in my ear, and he said, "Remember, you're a man."
Well, Colonel, that Iraqi man is potentially somewhere in the new Iraq.
Right, and there is also an individual that there is another whole story around the efforts of one of the senior leaders to get Iraq to support Article 3 of the Geneva Convention, he did that until the point that Cusay put him in prison.
Yeah, and which just speaks to, you know, how complicated this is, that you actually have some friends on the Iraqi side, even though you want Iraq to pay.
Right.
Yeah. Retired Air Force Colonel David Eberle is the senior officer of 17 former POWs who are appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court for compensation after being tortured during Saddam Hussein's regime following the first Gulf War. Colonel, thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Robin.
You're listening to Here and Now. Yesterday, an announcement by National Hockey League Commissioner Gary Bettman officially put the 2004-2005 NHL season out of its misery. The league had locked the players out in September, and the two sides have been unable to reach a collective bargaining agreement since then. This week, the Players Association had finally agreed to a salary cap, and the gap between the two sides had come down to a difference of only a few million dollars. Sports guru Bill Littlefield spoke to Los Angeles Times hockey writer Helene Elliott and asked her why an agreement to save the season couldn't be reached.
Well, that is a very good question. It's the $200 million question, actually, because as Commissioner Bettman was saying when some reporters put the exact question to him, you know, saying that it just seems like such a small gap, why couldn't you compromise? He said it's not really a $6.5 million gap. You'd have to multiply that $6.5 million times 30 teams. So it's actually closer to $200 million worth of difference. And he said, we just didn't have that to give.
Were you surprised that at the last minute the union relented and accepted the idea of a salary cap?
I was stunned, frankly. You know, they had just been so strong in saying, we will never accept a cap. We will never take this evil cap. And then you get this press release saying, we agreed to take a cap. And at that point, you really had to start believing, wow, they might get an agreement out of this. If that huge philosophical hurdle has come down, then maybe there's a way that they're going to work this out.
Well, since the players were the first to blink in this dispute, does that give the owners the upper hand so that we'll see a quick resolution once the two sides talk again, whenever that is?
Au contraire, mon ami. I think it's only going to get uglier from now on, frankly. I think that any deal that they get from now on that involves revenue sharing or any deal at all is only going to be worse, because canceling the season is just going to affect the NHL in so many ways, in terms of revenues, in terms of prestige, in terms of losing sponsors, that the NHL was fond of talking about how it was a $2.1 billion business, which is what their revenues were a couple of years ago. But since then, they've lost their major TV contract. They're going to lose a lot of advertisers. They're going to lose fans. So the pie that they're going to cut up is only going to be smaller from now on.
Commissioner Bettman claimed that all the national polls said that more than anything, fans wanted the league to achieve cost certainty. My impression was the fans just wanted to see hockey.
I would be with you on that one, frankly. I suspect some of the national polls included their relatives, friends, cousins-in-law, and people who deliver their newspapers. I think most people would like to see the game look a little different when they come back. I don't think most people care about cost certainty, frankly. They care about seeing entertaining hockey and getting their money's worth.
Could the apparent disconnect between what Commissioner Bettman and the owners see and what the fans actually think be the root of the National Hockey League's problems?
National Hockey League has an awful lot of problems at the moment, not the smallest of which being what happens if Commissioner Bettman decides to go ahead and unilaterally implement labor conditions and bring in replacement players. If you think things were nasty during the labor talks, wait until they try to do that. That could really get ugly. This league has a lot of big decisions to make in terms of how it's going to go forward. You know, Commissioner Bettman was very vocal in saying we can make 30 teams work. If with the right economic system, all 30 teams can survive. But I seriously doubt whether all 30 teams will still be in existence if this thing goes on past next season.
We've discussed a lot of ifs. What's your best guess about what Commissioner Bettman does next?
I think he's going to try to declare the impasse and implement the labor conditions and bring in replacement players. A lot of players and agents and people I've talked to are very strongly convinced that that's been his whole plan all along, to break the union. It's just going to be a very confusing and very fractious time, I think. You know, you're dealing with legal authorities in two countries and several different provinces within Canada, so it's just going to be a complete mess. And at the end of it, you have to stand there and look and go, was this really worth it?
Helene Elliott writes about hockey for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game and friend of Here and Now. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, taking a few minutes to air a few of your thoughts. In our primer on the Kyoto Protocol, Vijay Vaithiswaran of The Economist said that while the Bush administration did not join the accord, it has softened its position, acknowledging that global warming might exist. Well, that prompted Cassandra March to write, boy, did that make me chuckle. Just this week, I got a letter from my senator, Republican John Sununu of New Hampshire, describing how there is no scientific proof of global warming. If we continue to have a government which props up pollution and refuses to listen to ordinary people, well, we'll never get out from under our own mess, will we? After our interview with Jeff Gannon, a.k.a. James Guckert, the partisan reporter who recently quit his job at a Republican-funded website, Laura O'Meara, a Democrat from Cape Cod, wrote, wow, leave this guy alone. He's either a bad reporter or a fan of the White House. But it's not like he's Robert Novak, the conservative who outed CIA agent Valerie Plame in his column. Well, Laura, point taken, but Jeff Gannon actually called us and asked for time on the air. We were happy to oblige. And these corrections. When we spoke this week with Richard Kramer, the homeless man who's suing the New Jersey Transit Authority, we left the impression that he's being represented by the ACLU. He's not, although they support his thinking that the homeless shouldn't be kicked out of train stations for no reason. And when we reported on the Halliburton Company's lost package of nuclear material discovered in a Boston warehouse, we called it americium. Well, Pasquale Tato of Cambridge, Massachusetts must be a bus driver because he took us to school. Pasquale writes, remember the periodic table of the elements? Well, americium, let me try that again. Americium is element number 95, right after plutonium, symbol AM, a white metallic element of the actinide series having isotopes with mass numbers from 237 to 246 and half-lives from 25 minutes to 7,950 years. Its longest-lived isotopes, AM241 and AM243, are alpha-ray emitters used as radiation sources in research. I knew that. Just in case you were looking for another example of the cultural differences between Asia and the West, researchers at a psychiatric hospital in Massachusetts have one for you. A new study out from Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital says Asian men are not as dissatisfied with their bodies as Western men are. The findings are only preliminary, and the researchers can only theorize about the reasons behind them. So Here and Now's Sean Cole did some theorizing right along with them.
One of the authors is a psychologist named Harrison Pope. For the last 20 years or so, he's been researching a disorder that he calls muscle dysmorphia, in which men are so fixated on building their bodies up that they've become pathological. Pope says the disorder is common enough that some guys have a nickname for it.
Bigorexia, meaning sort of a reverse of anorexia nervosa, in which a guy looks in the mirror and thinks that he looks too small when he's actually big.
Of course, it's a long way from wanting more muscles to having full-blown bigorexia. But Pope says a lot of men have a bit of the bigorectic in them. In the course of his research, he conducted a body image test with about 200 men in America and Europe. Each sat down in front of a computer screen depicting a little cartoon man that they could make fatter or thinner, brawnier or scrawnier. They were then asked to mold the cartoon into the image of their own body, the average male body, their ideal physique, and the body women desire most.
And in Austria, Paris, and Boston, the men thought that women wanted a male body with about 20 or 25 pounds more muscle than an ordinary man. But when we then turned around and gave the computer to actual women in these cultures, the women chose a perfectly ordinary-looking male body without all of the added muscle packed on it.
Pope wondered if the same would hold true in Asian cultures, where attitudes surrounding masculinity are generally different than ours. So in June of 2002, he enlisted the help of Jeff Yang, a young Taiwanese-American Harvard student who happened to be going to Taiwan to visit family. For the most part, Yang is a perfectly normal biochemistry major, a little on the slimmer side, maybe a little shy. And suddenly, he finds himself administering this same computerized body image test to 55 Taiwanese college guys. As it turns out, they were a lot more accurate when it came to the body women desire most, overestimating by only 5 pounds of muscle. Yang says he also interviewed a bunch of doctors and trainers about body image while he was there, using the Mandarin word for muscle, which is
肌肉,
the same as the Mandarin word for chicken meat. Yang says his interviewees became confused.
They thought I was asking if Taiwanese guys are afraid of chicken meat. The idea that somebody would be concerned about their muscularity is just so foreign in Taiwan that this word, 肌肉, they would associate it with chicken meat first.
Yang and Pope say muscle dysmorphia is almost unheard of in Asia. Their theories as to why this is range from differences in pop culture and media advertising to centuries-old ideas of what makes a man in both cultures. Yang told me that the Confucian ideal of masculinity is twofold. First, you have to have
wen.
That's W-E-N, which relates to a kind of cultural and academic prowess.
And also wu.
Spelled W-U, which deals with physicality and martial or military skill.
And the traditional notion of the ideal or essence of masculinity, it's put more emphasis on wen over wu.
But there's another factor in Asia that seems to blur the line between wen and wu a bit. We'll call it the Bruce Lee factor.
I was brought up pushing for the wen, but I always like wu.
This is Yao Li, a well-developed kung fu instructor at a martial arts school in Boston. We sat down in his studio together before his morning class. As a boy growing up in Taiwan, he says, he wanted to be like the heroes in the martial arts stories he was reading.
But I want to be more than just muscular. I want to learn the secrets too, like the internal. Like we always say, like, you know, I'm going to use my chi to beat you up.
Use my energy.
Right, exactly. I'm going to use my chi to beat you up.
The way Yao Li sees it, male physicality in America is actually trending away from brawn and more toward chi. Jeff Yang, on the other hand, says he's noticed that boy bands in Taiwan are starting to buff up a little bit. Not that he listens to those bands. If that's true, the women of Taiwan might be a little bummed out about it. Since I didn't have time to actually go to Taiwan, I traveled from my office down one flight of stairs to an English language school below. There were two Taiwanese women in the class I attended, and I'd heard something about one of them in particular that made me think she'd be a good spokesperson for the women of Taiwan. She usually goes by the name Ah Mei.
In Taiwan, girls like men look fit.
Mm-hmm.
Fit. And if he has a big muscle, the girl will, how do you say? Run away. Yes.
And I'm sure that any guy that made Ah Mei run away would be heartbroken. She's intensely beautiful. She is also one of the most famous pop stars in Asia, the Christina Aguilera of Taiwan. She just happens to be studying English in the States for a few months. If you don't believe me, listen to how Jeff Yang reacted when I told him she was here. She's his aunt's favorite singer.
I'm astonished.
Yeah, I thought you would know who she was.
Oh, man. Wow.
I also told him what Ah Mei said about muscle-bound men.
Anecdotally, I know just talking with some friends in Taiwan that for them it's more important how a guy's facial features look rather than their muscularity. They might like Tom Cruise more than Vin Diesel or something.
Of course, if you're a single American male listening to this, none of what you've heard so far is going to be much help unless you're planning to spend time in Taiwan. But rest assured, in another extremely scientific survey I conducted of 12 American college girls, only one preferred really buff guys. Good news for the average male, but not, as it turns out, for researcher Harrison Pope. That's right. Dr. Pope is jacked.
You know what's really ironic, Dr. Pope, is you are really buff. Like, you have huge arms. I'm looking at you, and you're like, how much can you bench press?
Well, I used to bench press 315, but now I have rotator cuff problems, so I can't do any bench presses at all, or else my shoulder starts to hurt.
Still, at least for now, he probably won't be turning any heads in Taiwan.
That's reporter Sean Cole. I just want someone I can hold on to. I want myself. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.